Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, that show that, were it a documentary, would play more like This is Spinal Tap than, say, The Thin Blue Line. Some of us, after all, do like to push our emotions to 11. No names. Speaking of documentaries, that's what's on tap for the three of us this week. We'll begin by discussing Dick Johnson is Dead, Kirsten Johnson's unique love letter to her aging father. Then we'll continue with the biographical study, Oliver Sacks' own life. And we'll finish with a bit of true crime titled American Murder, The Family Next Door. Let's begin this week's show by taking a look at all the ways one filmmaker can kill a parent, but do so with love. Dealing with the demise of a parent is never easy, and it felt particularly hard for documentary filmmaker Kirsten Johnson, which is how she came up with a quirky idea. She would find ways to imagine her elderly father dying over and over, film it, and through the exercise, maybe make herself better prepared for when the real event occurred. Maybe, of course, being the operative word. Filling her film with lots of details about her parents, both her dad and her late mom, and blending those personal touches with a few surreal sequences, Johnson has given us a study of love and tenderness that works in a way that I, for one, had never before experienced. Is Dick Johnson really dead? You'll have to watch the movie to find out.
You know, we've had a lot of form-busting documentaries this year. I mean, even ones we've talked about on the show, like Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, or The Mole Agent, where we've seen reality and fiction sort of become one in unusual, uncomfortable ways. But I think this one, Dick Johnson is Dead, is the most successful in combining verite footage with fictional staged footage. And what I find most profound about this is that it is a movie about death. You know that going in, but in that way, it's also about life and about this guy's life in particular. And it's also a movie about its own making, because we're watching as Johnson, the filmmaker, is sort of trying to figure out how she's going to put all these pieces together. And when she's making these staged death scenes, which are sometimes as basic as watching her father tumble down the stairs or a window air conditioning unit falling on his head as he's walking down the sidewalk, just these kind of gruesome, bloody sequences that kind of play out as dark comedy. As we're watching those, we see the film crew putting them together. So it's never really the case of her trying to slip fiction into the film, although those lines do blur more and more as the film goes on. She's always kind of showing her hand. And her father, Dick, is there watching the whole time, although his grasp on what's going on, kind of loosens as he slips further into dementia. And so I was thinking about it, like, it would be like watching someone write your obituary before you've actually died. That's sort of what's going on here. And there's so many individual moments in Dick Johnson is Dead that I think will probably stick with me forever, not just the gruesome horror scenes, but the moment where she's explaining to his father why she has to take his car away. And it's sort of this last vestige of freedom that he has. And we watch it play out in his face. Or the moment when they're clearing out his office because he was a psychiatrist for decades in Seattle. And they're finally cleaning out his office, and Johnson gets the handyman that's come in to do it to talk on camera about his own father's death. And then there's a moment where Dick is left alone as the rest of the family goes out trick-or-treating on Halloween, and he expresses his confusion and his anger and his disorientation in that moment. And then there's this entire staged funeral that happens. We see it at the beginning of the film and then at the end. And it's one of the most remarkable sequences I've seen in any movie in such a long time. And not only did it get me emotionally, but it's really funny and really powerful. And
At the same time,
there's a moment where I was tearing up, and then 2 seconds later had a gut laugh, where it was just something so crazy happens that's both beautiful and absurd at the same time. So this movie, Dick Johnson is Dead, which is on Netflix right now, this is easily my favorite movie of the year so far. I think it's the best thing that we've seen. It'll definitely be in my top 10 at the end of the year. I just think it's such a weird, remarkable piece of film. I've, like you said, Dan, I've never seen anything quite like this before.
I agree with everything that you've said, and I appreciated this film as well. It made me a little anxious at different points because I felt as though initially Dick Johnson, the dad, Dr. Dick Johnson, had bought into this. But as we see him becoming a little bit more uncertain about where he is and his dementia starts to take over, I got a little anxious or nervous about, you know, he clearly loved his daughter. So was he willing to do this for her? Was he willing to do this for himself? Or was she taking advantage of him in some strange way for her own purposes? And so that made me feel a little bit uncomfortable at different points. I have to say, though, the one thing that you didn't emphasize, and they never really delve as deeply into this as I thought might have been warranted, this family was a very devoted Seventh-day Adventist religious family, including the filmmaker at an earlier point, at least. And so here's this guy who is a neuropsychiatrist, and he's also, you know, a devout member of this religious group that seems to be somewhat at odds with his medical training and so forth. So there were some anomalies in this film that weren't explained fully. So I think from an emotional perspective and from a visual perspective, this film is, as you said, Nathan, this documentary is amazing. At the same time, I, you know, had some of these reservations that maybe you shared or maybe you didn't, or maybe your other opinions and impressions sort of took precedence over those sorts of matters that I raised.
Yeah, I was trying to find a way to, you know, very easily describe Dick Johnson is dead. At first, I thought, well, you know, there's a lot of MASH humor. But then I began thinking about that whole term MASH humor based on the Robert Altman movie. And MASH humor has a meanness to it. There's a kind of a funny, ha-ha kind of in-your-face moment, satire, cynicism. Yeah. And that is totally lacking in Johnson's film. Kirsten Johnson loves her father. And as we all, Mary Pat and I have both dealt with this, with the death of our parents, it's no easy exercise. And I don't judge anyone for how different they want to approach that really emotional passage in life. And I applaud her for finding a way of doing it that worked for her and ends up working for us also, even if, as with Mary Pat, you had some qualms along the way.
Well, and the other thing is, we didn't really mention the fact that all of a sudden it occasionally trips into this Broadway musical extravaganza, which I thought was an interesting turn. And we didn't really talk too much about the filmmaker. We talked about her relationship with Dad, but she's done a bunch of other things as a camera person. She's been involved in docs all over the world. She had an earlier doc camera person that I think we have some hints of her childhood and her life and so forth. But I thought her creativity in Dick Johnson is Dead is notable because she is dealing with her own emotions and she is dealing with her own family and she is dealing with her own Poppy. And it's clear that they do have a special relationship, and that had been true throughout her life.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when you're talking about those kind of ethical questions of, you know, how much was he able to consent to this? I think you do see that uneasiness in the film itself. There's a moment where they're filming a sequence in which he is attacked on the street, a fantasy sequence in which he's attacked on the street, and he's rigged up with this fake blood that's going to spurt out of his neck. And it's one of the most painful moments in the film because you get the sense that he doesn't really understand what's going on. And he's in pain, both physical and mental anguish over this scene. So I think we do see after that, the movie does change at that point. It's almost the fulcrum. And I want to say that at the center of this is Dick Johnson himself. And this guy, I mean, we really fall in love with this guy over the course of this movie. And so it becomes so painful to see the parts of him that we recognize at the beginning start to slip away. And like you said, I mean, I think we have all experienced that with loved ones where every time you see them, you recognize them less and less. And it's rare to see a movie that handles that, that looks at dead in the eye and shows you what that's like. And I want to stress that even though Dick Johnson is Dead is about death, I mean, I don't think that anyone's going to stumble into this not knowing that it's in the title, but this movie is somehow not a total downer. It's sweet and it's life-affirming. And it's, like you said, it's oftentimes quite surreal with these bizarre heaven sequences and these bloody gore sequences. And it's often very, very funny, but I do think that there is, you know, a wistfulness and a sadness about it. It's just, I can't say enough about it. It's probably not going to be for everybody, but it worked really well for me.
Not for everybody, but for most of us, I think. We're talking about the documentary, Dick Johnson is Dead. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts and Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Oliver Sacks, his own life, and American Murder, The Family Next Door. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
It's no secret these are uncertain times. The pandemic and the economy have been tough on individuals, businesses, and nonprofits of all kinds. If you are a member of Spokane Public Radio and can afford to help a little bit more, there is no better time. Please consider raising your monthly level or making an extra gift. Go to SpokanePublicRadio.org and look for the red donate button. Every dollar counts. Take this as an opportunity to help your community stay informed with fact-based news and information, and enlightened with some culture and entertainment. Help keep your public radio service going with your contributions. Thank you.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the documentary Dick Johnson is Dead. Let's now move to the biographical documentary Oliver Sacks, His Own Life, and then the true crime study American Murder, The Family Next Door. Let's begin by looking at a man who built a career around telling the stories of those who, in many cases, had lost the ability to speak for themselves. If you saw the 1990 film Awakenings, you know who Oliver Sacks is. He was the author of the book from which director Penny Marshall adapted her movie's plot. Likewise, you'd know him from many of his other books, mainly medical case studies, such as 1985's The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. But though he spent his life telling the stories of so many people, most of whom had contracted some sort of debilitating disease or condition, Sacks, who died in 2015 at the age of 82, saved his own story for last, blending archival footage with extended interviews both with Sacks himself and a host of his friends and colleagues. Director Rick Burns reveals how Private Torment helped teach Sacks that compassion for others was the best way he could manage to find a sense of inner peace.
I thought that I did know a fair amount about Oliver Sacks, but wow, this documentary opened my eyes to things with which I was unfamiliar. He published an essay, a story about himself, a sort of memoir piece in the New York Times as he discovered that he was dying. And so I had read that, but I didn't put together all the pieces of his life because he was from the UK. He comes to the US. And he lives this life that seems so, at least as a young man, that seems so at odds with the familiar Oliver Sacks that we know much later in his life.
We should point out that he fled to the U.S. Yes. For specific reasons.
And that's one of the most intriguing aspects of the film because he's gay. And his family and his mother in particular, with whom he was very close, could not accept his homosexuality. So he comes to the US, he goes to the Bay Area, he becomes, you know, this sort of bearish motorcycle guy, quite, again, at odds with what we think of his life later. But it also is very telling because even though Oliver Sacks, you know, is struggling to accept his own sexual orientation, and should have been very resentful and maybe even hateful toward his mom, who was so cruel to him, he's not. I mean, he still maintains this course of dealing with her that's almost inexplicable. Okay, fine. So he becomes someone who might be the most atypical medical student and ultimately doctor ever. And I think that the thing that impressed me the most about this documentary is the fact that you got to see his interactions with his patients in a way that Awakenings really trivialized, I think. So the movie Awakenings tells some of the story about his using some experimental means to get through to people who had been in this catatonic-like state for years and years. But more important, when we see Oliver Sacks with his real patients, I mean, his compassion and his interest in each of them as people and individuals just shines through in a way that's unique. And I've spent a fair amount of time over the course of my lifetime in psychiatric institutions because I represented people with mental disabilities. And honestly, I have never seen any medical professional, have this relationship with his patients in the way that Oliver Sacks is portrayed in this film. And then we find out that he never really does come to grips with his sexual orientation until late in life. He also had a drug addiction early on, and he sort of pours himself into his work subsequently. Now, the good news is, and I don't think this is going to be a surprise because he shows up earlier in the film, he does end up with a sweetie. And of course, I thought that that was one of the most touching aspects. But the loyalty that he engendered in his friends, in his coworkers, I mean, he worked with some of the same people for decades. That was really impressive to me.
We have to also mention he had 50 years of therapy also. So.
Psychoanalysis, yes, not exactly. Just therapy.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so the extent of my knowledge about Oliver Sacks does come from having seen Awakenings one time. So I guess it was nice to get filled in on his personal life. And you're right. I mean, you see pictures of him as like Marlon Brando in The Wild One. You know, he looks like a movie star on his motorcycle. And it's just, it does not compute because that's not the Oliver Sacks that I think of. But I mostly enjoyed this documentary as well. It was informative, and Sacks himself is, just such a great figure. But there's something that's starting to bother me about these personal documentaries, which we're getting a lot of, is that they're hagiographic for about 98.9% of their running time. There's one scene in this movie where the talking head interviewees bring up Oliver Sacks's critics. Obviously, any medical professional that becomes kind of like a pop science star always brings out critics. They mention it for, 30 seconds, and then it goes away entirely. I wanted to know more about the criticism of his methods. I wanted to know more about his own flaws and contradictions. I tend to like people more when I know about maybe the mistakes that they've made in their past, not just manners of addiction and that sort of thing. So I liked this movie. It's solid, but I'd like to see these movies get a little thornier in their depiction of the people that they're about, but maybe that's just a personal thing.
And that was Oliver Sacks' own life. Let's close with American Murder, The Family Next Door. So many cable TV channels, from Discovery ID to Oxygen, feature true crime shows that the genre's growth and popularity has been labeled a kind of true crime renaissance. That popularity extends to streaming services too, one of the latest being the Netflix story of a Colorado man named Chris Watts, who in 2018 confessed to murdering not just his pregnant wife, but also his two young daughters. Titled American Murder, The Family Next Door, the Netflix film unfolds in a manner unique to the form. We see the investigation, mostly chronologically, as revealed both through police body cams and interrogation tapes, archival news footage, and most tellingly, through social media platforms. The effect puts a spotlight on Watts himself, and yet, tellingly, never really answers the central question, how could someone do such a horrible thing? The tale that director Jenny Popplewell tells has a familiar feel. How many studies of sociopathy can there be? But for the true crime junkie, American Murder, The Family Next Door should prove to be a riveting view.
And I would suggest those of you who may be less familiar with the genre might appreciate this story is horrifying, so you can't appreciate that part of it. But the way this is put together, that we get this behind-the-scenes look in American Murder, The Family Next Door, to what is happening in the denouement of this couple's relationship is really unique. And so I'm not sure how they got the buy-in from all the different players to make this particular documentary, but it tells this true crime story and it tells about this family and it tells about the wife's illness and it tells about everything seems to be going well until it's not. And then, more important from my perspective, we see the relationship of the husband with his family. And so early on, you're not sure, oh, is this just a relationship that's spinning out of control for some reasons that maybe the wife is contributing to? Because as her best friend even acknowledges, she could be a little bossy. But then it just sort of goes into this incomprehensible territory. And like the sheriff said in American Murder, the Family Next Door, he's addressing the killer and he says, why didn't you just get a divorce? And that's, I think in all of these true crime stories, that's always the question we're asking. Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that?
Did you like this?
I, of course, liked this because okay. I like this genre generally. And so I'm very forgiving of any faults that these films tend to have. And I don't know what that says about my psyche. Maybe I need 50 years of psychology well, to figure it out.
Maybe so. Well, I kind of hated this. I like a good true crime story as much as the next person. I just thought this was just a recitation of gruesome evidence. We find out what happened and then it's over. And there's no real insight here into why somebody would do something like this, which is, you know, what a good true crime doc can do. And so it just feels exploitative and seedy, and I wish I hadn't watched it.
So exploitative of the victim and
of the crimes, of the details of the crimes, yes.
And that was the Netflix true crime documentary American Murder, The Family Next Door. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. Earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed two other documentaries, Dick Johnson Is Dead and Oliver Sacks, His Own Life. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that streaming cinema has to offer. Until then, remember these words from the late Oliver Sacks. Language, that most human invention, can enable what, in principle, should not be possible. It can allow all of us, even the congenitally blind, to see with another person's eyes. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.